From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, NPR reporter John Hockenberry shares with us the excitement and the insanity of covering the Middle East. Hockenberry has just returned to the States and will be hosting a new NPR program. Also today, we meet Henry Hampton, the creator of Eyes on the Prize, Public Television's documentary series on the civil rights movement. Part two of the series is about the movement in the cities of the North. Hampton says telling this story has been more difficult than telling the story of civil rights in the rural South. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bette Midler's new movie, Stella. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh today asked a special court to appoint an independent counsel to investigate allegations of criminal wrongdoing by former Housing Secretary Samuel Pierce. In a letter to the House Judiciary Committee, Thornburgh said the special counsel would investigate allegations that Pierce and other HUD officials may have committed crimes in administering the Moderate Rehabilitation Federal Housing Program between 1984 and 1988. The Special Division of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a brief statement disclosing that Thornburgh had sought that appointment. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney told a Senate panel today that the U.S. could remove the troops that President Bush suggested cutting from Europe in no more than 2 years, NPR's Brian Naley reports.
Cheney said the timetable was subject to negotiation, but the reduction of up to 80,000 U.S. troops could be achieved in a year or two. Like Cheney, General Colin Powell stressed before the Senate Armed Services Committee the Bush administration's belief that modernizing the U.S. strategic arsenal must continue, despite the decrease in East-West tensions.
By the mid to late 90s, Soviet mobile systems could well comprise one half of their total ICBM force. To continue to provide a credible deterrent, we also need mobile missiles and systems such as the B-2 that are capable of holding at risk these Soviet mobile missiles.
Some senators, however, were skeptical about the administration's go-slow approach towards arms cutbacks and questioned the proposed billion-dollar increase in Star Wars funding. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
In a surprise move, Bulgaria's communist government resigned today after failing to persuade opposition parties to join a coalition to run the country until free elections in May. Meanwhile, the danger of civil war in the Yugoslav province of Kosovo has increased dramatically, with military units being sent to that region. The move will help satisfy the Serbian minority who have been demanding the government impose martial law. But the Albanian majority is threatening an all-out uprising unless the authorities begin an immediate dialogue. Pierre Vickery reports.
The Yugoslav presidency has deployed tanks, troops, and warplanes in Kosovo in a dramatic escalation of the conflict. It's the first direct military involvement since riots began 10 days ago, but was not enough to calm the tension. Tens of thousands of ethnic Albanians again took to the streets of several towns protesting against the state of emergency. The Slav minority has been demanding better protection, and hundreds of Serbian children have been evacuated. Six more demonstrators are reported killed, taking the death toll to at least 40. The federal government has sent a senior minister to try and negotiate an ethnic conflict, which many see as Yugoslavia's most serious political crisis in 50 years. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today as the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 4 points. This is NPR. The process of picking a jury in the trial of fired Exxon Valdez Captain Joseph Hazelwood came to a temporary halt today in Anchorage, Alaska. The judge in the case is taking time to consider whether to force the Coast Guard to comply with a defense subpoena seeking documents in the case. Hazelwood faces a possible 7 years in prison if convicted of criminal charges in the nation's worst oil spill, which occurred last year. On Friday, the Chrysler Corporation will close its aging Jefferson Avenue assembly plant in Detroit. Today, the Chrysler Board of Directors confirmed that yet another plant will close, this time in Missouri. Paul Eisenstein reports.
On September 21st, Chrysler will mothball one of two assembly plants in St. Louis, a move that will leave 3,700 workers without jobs. The decision to close the St. Louis 1 plant was anything but unexpected. U.S. new car sales have, on the whole, been declining in recent months, and Chrysler's market share has been on a particularly sharp decline. Some of the automaker's plants are currently running at barely 20% of their capacity, and that's forcing Chrysler to close its Jefferson Avenue assembly plant in Detroit tomorrow. Industry analysts say the automaker may be forced to close even more plants before the end of the year. The United Auto Workers Union has expressed outrage at the latest news, and plant closings and job security will be critical issues when the two sides sit down to bargain a new three-year contract this summer. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Eisenstein in Detroit.
Federal health officials say the so-called safe sex revolution may have slowed a bit. The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta says the number of syphilis cases hit a 40-year high last year with an estimated 44,000 cases. South African President F.W. de Klerk today denied reports that he met jailed nationalist leader Nelson Mandela for talks ahead of a speech he'll be giving to Parliament this Friday. A statement from de Klerk's office said that no meeting took place today between the two. There have been reports about an impending release for Mandela, but a spokesman for de Klerk said that she had no comment on any of the stories. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you listen to NPR news programs, you're already familiar with the work of my guest, John Hockenberry. He just returned to the States from Jerusalem, where for close to 2 years he covered the Middle East for NPR. Many of his stories followed the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. But while he was overseas, he also went to Iran to cover the funeral of the Ayatollah and to Romania to cover the overthrow of Nicolae Ceausescu. According to the LA Times, Hockenberry became something of a legend in the Middle East, among reporters, and among the growing legion of wounded and disabled Palestinians, because of his remarkable mobility in his wheelchair. He's paralyzed from the waist down as a result of a spinal cord injury 14 years ago. John Hockenberry has worked for NPR since 1981. He won a Peabody Award for his story of a 13-year-old who was shot in the back and lost the use of his legs. Another of his celebrated pieces was about a radio DJ with Tourette syndrome. Hockenberry will be hosting a new NPR late-night program called Heat. It premieres on many public radio stations in March. I asked him about why he wanted the Middle East assignment.
Well, actually, I wanted some kind of foreign position, overseas position. I mean, it was very frustrating for me in 1982 when I was a newscaster, for all things considered, covering the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. There just seemed to, you know, Shiites were the crazy people. The Israelis were the tragically flawed, you know, stalwart soldierly heroes trying to do something that we all sort of understood to be right. And then the Palestinians were the, you know, poor, you know, dark-skinned third world victims. And that was as sophisticated as it got in the American coverage. And when you're doing a newscast, you know, you're kind of really a prisoner of the information coming in off the wires, you know, which has been filtered through about 10,000 different Western filters. And I really felt as though I wanted personally to have a much better context for what the heck it was that was going on in the Middle East. So I had spent a lot of time studying about the Middle East, but again, never expecting to go. So all of those things kind of went vroom together when the position opened.
I think there are really very few precedents for foreign correspondents who use wheelchairs. And I was wondering if you had frank talks with your editors about what it would be like to overcome the logistical problems getting around in the Middle East.
In a wheelchair?
Yeah.
You mean, you think I'm in a wheelchair? I've always wanted to do that on the air, Terry. I just, it's part
sorry,
of the magic of radio.
I'm
sorry it had to be you, but I've just always wanted to do to someone. I've imagined it for years, and I'm a bad, I'm a very bad disabled person. But we actually didn't discuss it. I mean, yes, I am in a wheelchair, and lest there be no doubt. And Mom, no, nothing's changed. It was a strange kind of discussion. I'm trying to recall it now. I mean, the NPR editors, and editors are always this way, I think, whether they're with NPR or something, they're just like, well, John, you know, you'll just have to handle it, right? You know, and I mean, okay, yeah, sure. But they didn't understand what the problems were going to be. And I really didn't understand what the problems were going to be either. I mean, I had this sense that actually it would be a heck of a lot easier outside of the United States reporting than it ever was in New York or Chicago or the Pacific Northwest. And indeed, that is what it turned out to be. I mean, I think physically it's very exhausting to, if you happen to be disabled and working in a foreign beat.
Well, I heard that there's because of all the fighting in the Middle East, there's so many people with disabilities that there's maybe more accommodations made for it.
Actually, that's absolutely not the case.
Really?
It's shocking, really. I mean, whether you're in Iraq, in the Iran-Iraq war, in Iran or Iraq, or just simply in Israel, even. And if you're in Israel or if you're in the occupied territories, I mean, Israel has had extraordinary injuries among its population because of the wars. The Palestinians have had extraordinary injuries, especially during the Palestinian uprising, that have caused permanent disabling situations. You just never see these people. I think it was very strange. I mean, I always felt like I was the only disabled person in the universe in any of these places. I mean, in the case of Israel, I think there's a real problem physically with people sort of coming out and being out in the streets and stuff. They sort of hang around in their cars, and the government gives them cars. And I mean, I don't know if this makes much sense, but you kind of understand this sort of compensatory mentality, because, I mean, if you've come out of a physically disabled, you know, hospital setting, and, you know, you have a car for a while, and then you kind of have to make this psychological jump to sort of be out. Because there's a tremendous tendency, if you're a disabled person, to kind of hang in a little rut that's safe to you. And in Israel, I was amazed to the extent to which these people had done this. In the Arab world, it's, I think, if anything, it's even worse. I think people are taught to kind of, you know, pray for a miracle, and there are great difficulties getting quality medical care in the occupied territories, partially because of the Israelis. I mean, mostly because of the Israelis, but there's also psychological barriers, and I noticed this all over the Third World. But in for me, that's what made it easy. I mean, I sort of would come in there, and hi, I need to go up 5 flights of steps to interview, you know, Ahmed bin Ahmed, and suddenly there were 50 people, and we were all going upstairs, and you know, then I had 50 more people to interview if I wanted, and you know, it's kind of an international symbol. Of you know, wheelchair at bottom of the stairs.
Did you ever get nervous if you were parted from your wheelchair? You know, like, say someone stole it or something? This is the kind of thing I would worry about.
Well, the only time I actually worried about this was at Khomeini's funeral, which was a complete logistical nightmare. I mean, first of all, it's Khomeini's funeral. Second of all, there's 10 million other people there. And third, or 5 million other people there. Third, I mean, I was, you know, from this non-existent public radio network, as far as the Iranians are concerned, and I'm American anyway, so, you know, and the New York Times and all the rest of the press corps are there, so you have to figure out some way of getting on, like, the helicopters first, for instance, and everyone was trying to get on these helicopters to go and view from above Khomeini's funeral to get a sense of the scale of the crowd, because we were being kept sequestered, pretty much. And I remember this guy just comes up behind me as I'm rolling, and he wouldn't leave me alone. He's trying to push me, and he's pushing pushing me here and pushing me there, and I'm just like, you know, thank you very much. And, you know, nice guy. He doesn't speak any English, so, you know, I couldn't actually talk to him, but there he was pushing me. And so he realized that I wanted to get on the helicopter. And the New York Times and the Washington Post and NBC News are all there with their, you know, Iranian fixers who are thinking, please, we have to go very, very soon, very quickly now. And they're trying to, you know, strong-arm their way onto the helicopter first. And this little, thin Iranian guy, dear man, starts screaming something at this Iranian National Guardsman. And suddenly, boom, I'm in the front of the line. And I get into the helicopter, and I can't take the wheelchair into the helicopter. And the helicopter lifts off the ground, and here's this little guy running away with my wheelchair, you know, to sort of save it for me. And I mean, there was really nothing to do at that point. I mean, I guess, well, we'll come back, and there'll either be the wheelchair there or there won't be, you know.
Well, how did you hook up with it again?
Look, the helicopter comes back after 5 minutes, and here's this guy running around in the parking lot. He sees the helicopter, he memorized the number or something, and he knew exactly when I was coming back or something, and there he was again. And I guess the lesson is, you know, if you can't trust someone on the day of Khomeini's funeral who you've known for 10 minutes with your wheelchair, who can you trust? It was the only time I ever worried about it, but, you know, these things are, oddly enough, much more of a problem in the United States than they are in the West than they are in the Third World. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, getting upstairs in the city of New York or Los Angeles or Chicago. I mean, if I was doing an interview or something and I was down somewhere on the street and I needed to go up 5 steps, I mean, Americans typically respond to this sort of thing with a kind of a, Oh, God. Oh, are you lost? Oh, I'll call somebody. I mean, what's the 800 number? I mean, I paid this tax. I mean, this is disgusting. I thought we took care of this problem, you know, but they won't help you. I mean, they can't actually lift you up the stairs. So that was really quite good. I mean, I wish I could go back.
My guest is NPR reporter John Hockenberry, and he just returned from nearly 2 years covering the Middle East for NPR. And now he's about to host a new daily late-night talk show called Heat, which will debut on many public radio stations in March. You left in March of 88 to become to report on the Middle East. The Intifada, the Palestinian uprising, was kind of at its height then. How did you see it change during the, year and a half or so that you were there?
The uprising is an event in a set of political realities which have not changed since before the 1940s, really. I mean, the 1967 war was a change of borders, but clearly the Israelis have not come to, and the Zionist Jews who constituted Israel have not dealt with the presence of an indigenous Arabic population. Similarly, for a whole variety of reasons, the people who are politically responsible in the Arab world have not dealt with the presence of Israel. The uprising itself was one in a series of eruptions because the situation is completely unresolvable. And if you're there, you understand that it's not resolvable in any traditional sense that we understand in the West. And it transformed itself, and I could feel this happening in me, into a war of attrition, and that's very much where it stands now. It's a very mean-spirited, bloody conflict that's, you know, killing, you know, Arab young people, you know, one or two per day. And, you know, now we don't hear about it because there's no political miracles in the Middle East. That's the place that distinguishes it from somewhere like Eastern Europe, where, you know, Steven Spielberg could perhaps imagine the special effects going on there. But in the Middle East, it's the same old story.
John, can I ask you for an example of a story that was particularly challenging for you in terms of the ethics or the point of view? You know, where you understood what the two sides were and you had to decide how to present those two sides?
I think there was no particular story, but you would always encounter things that where people would say things in context. And, you know, you would have real difficulty airing them, or you would air them and you would get all kinds of inflammatory response. I can certainly remember very early when I got there, a couple of boys, this is in the middle of Israel's Independence Day celebration, which is it's kind of a family riot that takes place in Tel Aviv and especially in Jerusalem, where people run around and hit each other with plastic hammers and spray, silly foam on each other. You know, it's not drunken at all, but it is very wild. But anyway, in the middle of this are all these kids, and they're celebrating the Independence Day of Israel. And I asked them, what you want to do when you grow up and what's going on? And the two kids said, I want to kill Arabs. And then they laughed and said, no, not really. And I said, well, but what do you want to do? Well, we want to join the army, and we want to, be heroes, and, you know, well, what will you do in the army? Well, we'll kill Arabs. And so, I mean, I aired a part of that, I was just very nervous about it, and indeed, there was all kinds of consternation and criticism leveled at the network for airing it, some of it internal, some of it external. Whereas, you know, if you were down in New York City, in the Bronx, and you were talking to two white kids for an interview on racism, and the two white kids said, yeah, I want to grow up and kill blacks, you would never have a hesitation to air this. I mean, because it would say something about some aspect of the community. I mean, you would set it in a certain context, and indeed I attempted to do that in Israel all the time. But the linguistic categories are so charged with voltage that you bump into these pitfalls all the time. You get kind of scared of the things that you see, and you feel very strongly a kind of self-censorship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, And then we'll talk some more. And my guest is NPR reporter John Hockenberry, who just came back a couple of weeks ago from covering the Middle East. He was there since March of 1988. And he's about to host a new late-night talk show called Heat, which will debut in March on many public radio stations around the country. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Hockenberry is my guest. Can I ask you a few questions about yourself?
Sure.
About your own background? Can you tell me about the accident that left your legs paralyzed? I think it was an auto accident when you were younger.
It was a car accident, and it was a terrible car accident, and it's a long time ago, 14 years ago now, almost exactly, and I. It seems like another life. It really, really does. I was 19.
Uh-huh.
I was like in school, man. You know, I'm gonna hitchhike to New York. From Chicago. We were gonna have like a really crazy weekend, and it was the worst hitchhiking ride I ever took.
The accident was while you were hitching.
Yeah. Boy. And but why do you say oh boy? A lot of people say, everyone says, oh, it was hitching. Oh. What do you mean?
Well, I used to hitchhike a lot when I was younger, when I was in college. And I remember a few rides with some really crazy people where I thought, well, you blew it this time. And it's the sense of really not having control. Now, right. I don't know whether these were competent drivers or not who you were hitching with, but I had some pretty close calls hitchhiking. Yeah. And I look back at that and really wonder how and why I did it.
Well, these people had been driving all night.
I see.
They fell asleep at the wheel, or she fell asleep at the wheel. Mm-hmm. But, my mother's response was really weird because she would say, well, you shouldn't have been hitchhiking. Because I used to get in trouble all the time with the juvenile authorities when I was a teenager because mm-hmm. I'd hitchhike and they'd give me tickets and I'd, tell the policeman something about the Bill of Rights, And my mother would have to be dragged in to this, juvenile place to be told, that the police of the city do not need lectures on the Constitution by a teenager, and maybe this means there's something wrong, with your son, Mrs. Hockenberry. And so I remember she would say, well, you shouldn't have been hitchhiking. We used to laugh at her about that. But, it took a long time. It was a serious injury. It took a long time to, sort of get back on your feet. I think actually the incident of the accident itself is less significant to me now. As an event, as the transformations that take place over an extraordinary period of time, 14 years, when you think about it, to sort of come, to fully sort of acquire a new life. And that's really what happens. And partially going away to the Middle East, doing an overseas assignment, it's an extension of that. You try to figure out exactly how free you can actually be physically.
Mm-hmm.
And while lots of people do that by climbing mountains or something or being some sort of super grip athlete, that had never any attraction to me whatsoever. Never.
Well, had you been athletic or, very, very physical person before the accident?
Oh, no, I was a clumsy oaf. I actually, with four wheels on the ground now, I'm like, Nureyev, But on two legs. No, I was a complete oaf. But I'm actually more athletic now in a sense. I mean, I enjoy, running or something, doing distance running. It's actually kind of a fun way to get around if you have a good, fast chair. But I don't do it for any kind of competition, and I just don't have time. I'd much rather, explore, I guess, is the way of saying it.
Now, tell me if this is an apocryphal story. I've heard that you were doing all these freelance assignments for the news editors at NPR in Washington, and that they had no idea that you were getting around on a wheelchair, and when they found out while you were filing a Mount St. Helens story on the volcano, that they were just really astonished.
Well, the story actually goes like this. and I, you know, I may be remembering it wrong, but I think this is how it goes. Only my editor really knew, Adrienne Chouffeau, at the time, who's since left. I think she works for some other company in Washington. But she was my editor in the beginning, and I had a big crush on her at the time also, which she'll, you know, she'll know about anyway. But she protected me, and she kept all this, you know, information that might damage my career from any of the other editors and stuff. And so we were very secretive about this thing. But one day she was absent, and her boss, John McChesney, who was the foreign editor for NPR for a while, he was running this particular unit, and I was editing with him. And I missed a deadline because I was out in the middle of this eastern Washington desert, dusty, plain, toothless chainsaw zone where there's just, I mean, all the phones are like phone booths, and there's just, it was very primitive, and the gas, you know, there was no way to file. There was just no way to file. Like, even the motels didn't have phones in the rooms, and all there was a phone booth, and I couldn't get into this damn phone booth. I could try to get the chair in, or I would get out of the chair, and then I'd be on the ground, and I couldn't coax it just wouldn't work, and I finally just gave up. I missed the deadline anyway. It drove me nuts, and, you know, a typical Protestant, you know, work ethic, fanatical American, you know, oldest child male is like, oh God, they're gonna fire me now. Oh, no, it's all over. I blew it. You know, it's terrible. You know, I'm trying to do this totally absurd, ridiculous thing, and McChesney gets on the phone. I remember, and he says to me, you know, why the hell didn't you file? You know, what happened? And I'm sweating all over, and I'm just all freaking out, and I'm. Well, I couldn't get my wheelchair into the phone booth. Well, okay, you know, and he didn't get it. You know, he couldn't get the wheelchair into the phone booth. He just didn't get it right away. And then I really don't know what happened. I don't know what his reaction was. I don't know if he really didn't know or what the exact story is. But then the rest of the week, for the next 2 weeks, people from NPR would call. John, I heard the most interesting thing about you the other day. is it true? You know, all these editors and these employees and stuff. Went, you know, I felt like, but out in Oregon, you know, where everyone's a hippie, and we used to hang with all these. You know, it's like I felt like I was, you know, coming out of the closet. You know, like I got lots of support, you know, from my friends and stuff.
You know what I'm wondering? How you feel about doing a studio-based show now after having been. You know, a foreign correspondent for over a year and a half. I assume that most of your interviews are going to be from the studio because you're going to have so many to do. It's going to be hard to get out of that studio, John.
No, I know. I want to ask you about this, Tara. I don't, you know, I actually, it's kind of weird. It'll be strange. I mean, also it's strange, you know, to get up in the morning and, you know, have a 9-to-5 kind of a job.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're sort of working all the time when you're in a foreign posting. But I mean, the advantage is definitely, I mean, one of the frustrations about being a foreign correspondent and doing news so much is that you don't get a chance to, I mean, you're witnessing extraordinary events, but you don't get a chance to kind of kick around the ideas that come out of them. So hopefully in this show, you know, it's certainly something that I want to do is really talk about some of the things that have happened, especially after this year. My God, I mean, what a year.
John, I look forward to hearing you on the air every day now in your new program, Heat, which premieres in March on many public radio stations. Welcome back to the States, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's nice to be back. Thank you very much, Terry.
John Hockenberry has been my guest, and he's a reporter with NPR, and for about a year and a half he was stationed in the Middle East reporting from there, and his new show, Heat, begins in March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actor Tom Hulse, and he played Mozart in the film Amadeus, also co-starred in Parenthood and Dominic and Eugene. He's now starring in the Broadway play A Few Good Men and in the upcoming NBC made-for-TV movie Murder in Mississippi. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1987, public television series Eyes on the Prize showed the story of the civil rights movement in the rural South. Now Eyes on the Prize 2 is continuing the story of the civil rights struggle in the cities of the North. Coming up, we talk with the executive producer of both series, Henry Hampton. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the updated version of the Hollywood classic Stella Dallas. This one's called Stella, and it stars Bette Midler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Radlin. The White House says President Bush will invite black South African leader Nelson Mandela and South African President F.W. de Klerk for separate visits once Mandela is freed. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
A statement issued by the White House said President Bush has been closely following the situation in South Africa and believes, quoting now, that President de Klerk has taken a number of courageous and important steps aimed at ending apartheid and moving toward a democratic and non-racial South Africa. Talking to reporters earlier today, presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater suggested that the White House expected Mandela to be released tomorrow. Later, in a clarification, White House officials said they had no independent indication of when Mandela might be released. Mandela, the 71-year-old leader of the African National Congress, has been in prison for more than 27 years. The White House says the president would meet separately with Mandela and de Klerk to see how the U.S. can best help South Africa move forward. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
The Mexican Navy says no drugs were found on a Cuban chartered freighter that was attacked by the U.S. Coast Guard yesterday. A Navy spokesman says nothing was found following a round-the-clock inspection when the freighter, the Herman, was met by Mexican Navy vessels. The freighter was riddled with bullets fired by a Coast Guard cutter before dawn yesterday after the vessel's skipper refused to let it be searched. The freighter fled from the international waters and its confrontation with the Coast Guard into Mexican territorial waters. It later docked in Tampico. Attorney General Dick Thornburg has requested the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate charges of criminal wrongdoing against former Housing Secretary Samuel Pierce. Pierce served as Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development throughout the Reagan administration. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
This evening, Thornburg asked a special three-judge court to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate fraud allegations. Thornburg's action came in response to a congressional request that triggered the special prosecutor's law. House Democrats had asked that a special prosecutor be appointed to probe charges of fraud and perjury against former Secretary Pierce, but Thornburg asked only that the special prosecutor be given a mandate to investigate the fraud charges. The special three-judge court will now select an independent counsel to investigate Pierce's role in the multi-million-dollar housing and urban development scandal. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The case brought against a pregnant mother charged with child abuse for allegedly drinking alcohol in violation of a judge's order will go forward. A judge in Laramie, Wyoming, refused to dismiss charges today against 29-year-old Diane Fannin Steele. At issue is whether the legal system should protect fetuses from the actions of their mothers. And on Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial lost over 4 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air.
I know the one thing we did right,
hey!
Was the day we started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Eyes on the Prize, Public TV's award-winning documentary series, began its second season 3 weeks ago. Eyes on the Prize chronicles the civil rights movement. The series was created by my guest, executive producer Henry Hampton. The first season covered the civil rights movement as it was unfolding in the South, the sit-ins, freedom rides, and the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. This season, the focus shifts to the North, where the battle lines weren't as clear. The series uses archival footage from the period, including TV news footage from local and national broadcasts. I wanted to know how Henry Hampton thought television coverage changed once the movement moved up north.
Well, there are a combination of factors, and one of the realities is that the instrument of television is really a new instrument in the early days of the movement, and it comes to learn some powerful lessons. It comes to learn that the morality play that's being acted out on the streets of the South makes for great television. You have tremendous villains. You have enormous moral strength of Dr. King and the marchers and the disciplined nonviolent movement. It is really unprecedented in terms of television, and it has an enormous impact on the instrument itself, which really grows up in the early stages of the civil rights movement. It also learns some bad lessons, which is that graphic violence and confrontation make great television. And as the battles of the civil rights era move to the North, the instrument finds that it can attract ratings and indeed audience by coverage of the violent confrontations. There are the realities that whereas many of the journalists and electronic and print are with the movement in the early stages, they are physically with them, looking outward at the difficult and dangerous sheriffs. By the time you move north, in many cases, those same journalists are standing behind police lines. The time that we reach when black Americans say to white journalists, we're going to have this meeting without you, or you can't come in here because you have misinterpreted or misrepresented, is a change point, because it really changes the basic relationship between the movement and media. But there was clearly a point at which people were suspicious and frustrated by the fact that their story was being told by almost all white people, and it was being told oftentimes incorrectly. And that frustration acted itself out by people saying, well, we just as soon not have anyone here while we try to come to grips with some of these issues and problems.
Now, how did those decisions of not having the press around affect you in putting together Eyes on the Prize, too? Because it means that there were probably certain really interesting inside events that weren't being filmed.
Well, don't forget, the press was around. What people said was that they always allowed the black press in. What they were oftentimes resistant to was opening it up to general press coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So there were witnesses inside of the many of the events that people don't think happened because the white press wasn't there. There were many fine black journalists who reported and gave dimension, oftentimes critical of what was going on. But they did it, I think, in a different way than people who perhaps didn't understand the full context of those events. But whenever you move away from the kind of public confrontations that occurred in the South, you're going to run into a more difficult story to cover. It happened in the South as well. It is very easy to cover the notion of a black American attempting to get their rights to vote when it's being resisted by state troopers and the kind of violence that was visited upon people who tried to vote. That makes great copy. It is very hard to watch that same person having achieved that right to vote go about the business of learning the nature of citizenship, for watching how black and white communities circle each other for a long time, struggling around new power relationships. These are things that media didn't do very well in the South. And when you bring them into the North, where you have the complexity of the urban environment and the really enormously sophisticated opposition that is practiced on the movement in the North, it becomes even more difficult.
What are some of the most interesting sources for the film that you're using in the current series of Eyes on the Prize?
Well, interestingly, we move into a period where there's much more coverage. People are picking up portable cameras. There are a lot of young people now who are involved and interested in the movement, and the excitement of what's going on in both the student movement and the civil rights movement is providing enormous material for new young journalists and new young documentarians. So there is a rich source in the second series that you don't have in the first. For example, there is some marvelous footage in the show that's coming on next Monday called The Promised Land of Dr. King, as he and the people of SCLC struggle to come up with reasonable strategies to get the society to come to grips with the issue of poverty. People rarely see, I think, leaders in this kind of candid exchange among staff members where they argue and scratch and claw trying to find what are proper and reasonable strategies. And there is footage inside the Black Panther headquarters in Chicago in show 206 as they know that they are under scrutiny and surveillance by the FBI and the Chicago police and are preparing to react. The sources in the second series tend to be less the networks, although an enormous amount of the material is from the network archives, and more from local stations. And there's both good news and bad news there. The local stations oftentimes had good coverage, and many of them have taken the positive step of archiving it with local universities and reservoirs that are going to protect it. But all too much of the material was lost because it was not of value immediately after broadcast. And so many of the stories that might have been covered originally, we've lost that material. And there's an interesting technical point here, is that now as we enter the era of videotape, where there are fewer and fewer things are outtakes of material. Almost everything that's preserved are the edited stories. So rather than having a bulk of material from which one can work, we are almost limited to the point of view, whether it be right or wrong, broad or narrow, of the person that edited the original story. So series like Eyes on the Prize are not going to be possible in the same way because there won't be the raw material from which one can edit.
Mm-hmm. Are there incidents that really look different to you now, looking at it as history, than they did to you at the time?
Oh, I think Malcolm is the perfect example of something that we all lived through. Probably 95% of the broadcast audience or the United States of America perceived Malcolm as he was portrayed by a few gatekeepers, as being largely an advocate of Black supremacy and anti-white rhetoric. And surely Malcolm in his early years did parrot and use that language and felt strongly about white crimes against Black blacks. But if you have to do is watch Malcolm a little bit to begin to understand how complex and how smart this man is and how he was changing. He was changing right before our eyes, becoming really a very important international leader. And I think people will see that footage of Malcolm sitting in Egypt talking about human rights, the notion of taking the case of Black Americans to the United Nations. Very sophisticated stuff, very different than the single image that was used to portray him. And there is, I think, a great lesson to be learned that when you are offered interpretations of particular characters, that one need take another look and then perhaps another look before you reach judgment. And I think that happens over and over again within the movement, there are moments which are either by virtue of the emotion or of the moment, people refuse to take the second look or the second step, and they are caught in time with that reaction to what they've been told.
My guest is Henry Hampton. He's the creator and executive producer of the award-winning public television series Eyes on the Prize. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Henry Hampton is my guest. He's the executive producer of the public television series Eyes on the Prize. Is there a sequence in Eyes 2 that is particularly painful or disturbing to you looking back?
There are a couple of moments that stop me. I guess there are two of them that I still find the most difficult. The first is Dr. King in Chicago. If you really have come to understand the power of the Southern movement, that you're aware of just what's at stake when we begin to find out it doesn't work up here, and yet it could, it had the capacity to work here, and as you watch it sort of unravel itself, to me it is very much a lost moment in the society that is impossible to reconstruct. There is the loss of Malcolm. I don't think people understand what a power that he could have been. He could have been as important in reaching African Americans in the urban environment as Dr. King was at reaching people in the South and the church-based movement. Together, if these two men had continued to move closer together, that we could have had a coalition of just enormous power that could have joined with the other members of labor and the churches. And if we had not gotten caught in the disaster of the Vietnam War, we literally could have changed the world and the country in that space in the 60s. And instead of having the kind of painful explosions that did occur.
Were you active in the civil rights movement yourself when you were younger?
Well, I was. I'm a good middle-class kid, and I went to Washington University in St. Louis. And in 1959 and 60, when I was going through, the restaurants around that school did not serve blacks. And there was a core chapter in St. Louis that connected with a few of us at the university. We just decided to go find out why we couldn't be served. And so for the last couple of years of my college life, we used to sit in. But after I graduated from school and after we'd successfully desegregated some of those restaurants, I really was not directly involved and only got re-involved in 1965 in Selma when I was the press officer for the Unitarian Church and went back to with the denomination because a white minister, James Reeb, had been killed.
You've spoke during this interview of the importance of both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. I was wondering if in the 1960s, when they were both still alive, if you felt that you had to somehow align yourself with one or the other, choose one's tactics over the other, and not, as you do now, see both as being really important for what they did. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I do. Most black Americans will now stand up, and when you say Malcolm, they'll either be neutral or they'll be positive about Malcolm. But in reality, most of us, when we first heard about Malcolm X, were scared to death. There was this man who was saying things that had some vague resonance in your soul, but they were also scary. And you also disagreed with some of the notions of race that were put forth early by Malcolm. I remember the first time I ever saw him was in Leverett House at Harvard. I was visiting a friend there, and Malcolm was speaking and just mesmerizing the audience. But he was talking about the failure of integration. And I had been someone raised to believe in integration and to pursue it assiduously, almost uncritically. And I stood up to take exception. And I've always been fond of Malcolm because while he did decimate me, he left me enough self-respect to sit back down quietly. You know, he was so smart and bright about both black history and the role of black Americans in this society. What he did was he provided sort of the other half. The manhood is a bad word because it excludes, but it, basically I can't think of the sense of self and the demand for respect that Malcolm put forth. Martin surely did, but Martin was in many ways ahead of his time. What a brilliant, wonderful notion to save a society through nonviolence. But as you do that, there is a cost to it. And if you are Dr. King, it doesn't matter because you believe so deeply in nonviolence. Your sense of self is anchored in the philosophy. But for most people, if somebody hits you in the nose and you don't react, there's an emotional cost. As healthy as it is not to, I think Malcolm's not being violent, because you really won't find any examples of Malcolm being involved in direct violence except his own death. There's much more death, in fact, around the nonviolent civil rights movement. But there was in Malcolm's demand that you don't touch me, or certainly don't beat or strike my women, that was just a powerful and I think important step for many of us who were struggling with what was a reasonable strategy to correct the ills in the society.
Do you find yourself looking at the events around you today and thinking, if I were to do Eyes on the Prize 3 in a few years, what from today and from yesterday would be in it?
Well, history is really, I really do believe history empowers, and it empowers because it allows you to make connections. There's no way you can sit in the city of Boston in the last 6 weeks reacting to the Stewart case and the kind of emotional terror and hurt that the city has undergone and make any sense of it. But if you have the connections to the historical moment, I think you get a sense of really what's possible and where we are. And one of the things history tells you is that it's oftentimes difficult to figure out. And when things seem the darkest, it's right before something is about to happen. If you look at the world in 1953, in 1954, even after the Brown decision, it doesn't look terribly positive for change. And yet history gives us the kind of vision that says there were an enormous number of forces building up so that when 54 happens and the signal of the Brown decision happens, that you have a race of people that's ready, you have a nation that's ready to undo its negative heritage. And so in 10 years, the first stage of the civil rights movement happens quickly and efficiently and marvelously. It was a miracle that it occurred and changed our nation. I think now, as I look back, you can begin to see that we are right at the edge of something. I think we are looking at a generation of black leadership and white leadership that has gone through a doldrum and is now getting ready to assault the problems that bedevil us.
Henry Hampton is the creator and executive producer of the public television series Eyes on the Prize. He's also the co-author of the companion book, Voices of Freedom. Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. European reaction tonight favorable mostly to the plan for further cuts in U.S. troop numbers in Europe that was announced in the President's State of the Union message last night. A county health department in West Virginia, in the southern part of the state, is facing having to close down, and they're asking for foreign aid as a third world country, aid from France and the Soviet Union and the United Nations. A report by Katie Davis on pollution problems in Mexico City. And we have one letter from one listener this evening. It's more about coffee consumption and sex among older people. And a report on cactus rustling in the American Southwest.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Bette Midler has her own production company called All Girl Productions on the Disney lot in Burbank. Midler's second movie from All Girls is opening this weekend. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Stella.
Bad movies come in all shapes and sizes. But for the moment, let's divide them into two categories. The ones you just can't watch, and the ones you watch with your eyes popping. Stella falls into the eye-popping category. Not, I'm afraid, because it's entertainingly bad, but because you can't believe people would actually mouth these lines, subject themselves to these stagings, or wear these clothes. The movie is, of course, the big new Bette Midler remake of the classic weepy, Stella Dallas. The material was first filmed, somewhat stiffly, in 1925 by Henry King, and then more spectacularly in 1937 by King Vidor. That version starred the late Barbara Stanwyck, in one of her greatest performances, and it seems appalling that she should reside so briefly in her grave before having to roll in it. The story is all about self-sacrifice, class prejudice, and family ties, Mittler plays Stella, who in this version is a bartender. When a handsome young doctor, played by Stephen Collins, makes her pregnant, she knows marriage won't work, because she and Collins are from different classes, different worlds. In the end, she has the baby, and naturally turns out to be a swell mom, but Stella is vulgar, uneducated, and she can't offer her blossoming daughter the advantages her father might have. Still, there's nothing like a mother, as you can hear in this scene, in which the daughter, played by Trini Alvarado, is on her way to visit her doting dad in New York, and Stella shows up at the airport to say goodbye.
Jenny! 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 Oh, Jenny! Oh, God, baby, I'm so sorry. I caught you there. I won't see him anymore except as a friend.
Mom, I did not sleep with him, okay?
You didn't? Oh, darling!
Oh, I just
thanked you. Oh, Jenny, I knew you were.
I'm going to miss
you. Look what I bought you. Look what I bought you. A little dressy sweater in case you have to go somewhere.
Mom, that's expensive.
I know, but you're going to look so beautiful.
Look, it's your color. Look at that.
Oh.
If you were late tuning in, you might think that we had just broadcast some heavy-breathing sex scene. And you wouldn't be far wrong. In this movie, mother love is downright orgasmic. The whole picture is devoted to the erotics of noble sacrifice, of smiling through your tears, of doing what's best for your daughter even when it hurts. This sort of thing could work despite the schmaltz back in 1937, but that was because Vidor and his screenwriters let Stella be a grasping gold digger as well as a great mom. They gave her dimension, and a character whose vulgarity was part of a complex whole. In the new version, Stella's vulgarity is just a device, pasted on so it can be exploited, when the filmmakers want to show Stella embarrassing her daughter in front of the girl's hoity-toity friends. As for Midler, well, I can't figure out what she thinks she's doing. As she glumps through Stella's tiny apartment like a fullback, pulling her mouth into a clownish frown, her performance seems half-parody. Is she portraying Stella or making fun of her? Midler has for years been the great sashaying hussy of the movies. Bold, funny, wonderfully naughty. A Mae West with range. In The Rose, she proved she could be a marvelous dramatic actress as well, but now that she's been given the chance, she keeps choosing these wildly maudlin vehicles. First beaches, and now this. Where's the real bet now that we need her? Stella's the kind of pious claptrap the divine Miss M would have been thumbing her nose at on every stage in America.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Bergen and Roberta Sherrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Actor Tom Hulce starred as Mozart in the movie Amadeus. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us about his new made-for-TV movie about the murders of civil rights workers Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. Also, the story behind the story of the three whales trapped in the Alaskan ice back in 1988. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.